Hello everyone and welcome to the NBL Pocket Podcast. This is episode 31. My guest this week is Jeff Van Groningen, former GM of the Sydney Kings and Brisbane Bullets and others. Jeff's been around the NBL for an incredibly long time and knows a lot. In our conversation today, we talk about driving international interest, in particular Chinese and Filipino interest in the NBL, and what Jeff tried to do when he was with the Kings and what he thinks are good measures for the future. We also talk about Brian Bowen and the Next Stars program. At the time of recording, Bowen had not been selected in the draft and nor had he signed that deal with the Pacers, but I'll talk about that in a second. We also talk about LaMelo Ball and Hampton, obviously, and how they've been the crown jewel of the NBL offseason, their impact, but also the expectations on them, and also the situation that surrounded their signing and what Jeff presumes, or at least what happened with Brian Bowen, and perhaps then what would have translated between Illawarra and the Breakers and Hampton and Ball. We talk about Aaron Brooks and how, you know, that signing and how that may have came about, and also what it's like signing a guy who's had been that long out of basketball. And we sort of talk about the correlation between Aaron Brooks' break from basketball and Andrew Bogut's break from basketball and how the two might mirror each other and how a player gets ready under those circumstances for the NBL season. We talk about the decision of the NBL in 1998 to switch from winter to summer and Jeff's thoughts on that. And we also talk about the future of the NBL in summer and in general in Jeff's eyes. And he gives a very good answer to you know, whether the game should switch back to winter or what's the best way forward for the NBL. And I don't know if Jeff's given the answer anywhere else, but his explanation of what the future of the game and what the future of the NBL is and the appeal of it and the possible avenues you can take the growth of the game in, very good answer. And then we talk about the fun of Summer League and what GMs are doing in the NBL right now in late June and early July. Which is an interesting conversation. He talks about the personas of each NBL coach and general manager during Summer League, what they're actually like there in Vegas. Going on, this is stuff I didn't talk with Jeff about, but stuff that's worth noting. Obviously, the NBL Select has finished its tournament in China, losing two and winning one, the third game. Again, it's a preseason tournament, so I'm not reading too much into it. A couple of things I did like was Corey Webster looked fantastic, and hopefully he can carry that form into next season. Mitch Norton looked like he'd sort of recovered pretty well from that calf injury. We kind of forget about that now because he came back during the finals, but yeah, he looked quite good defensively and is still kind of rearing up for the season. A lot was said about Daniel Johnson's defense. Again, preseason tournament, I'm not reading too much into it, and I didn't actually see game two. I saw game one and three, and only a dotted viewing of game two. I really enjoyed Santa Maria and Werther commentating that game, though. I thought they were really, really good, and hopefully we see more of them next season. Cam Luke was good, too. But fun little thing, I was really impressed by the Chinese. I thought their bigs were pretty good, and I thought their guard play had improved since the last time I saw them at, I don't know where it was, championship or Olympic play somewhere. Talking about Brian Bowen now. So, obviously, unfortunately, not taken in the draft. Would have been nice to see that, but did sort of immediately on from that sign a deal with the Pacers. Now, it's my understanding that the Pacers had two selections in the draft. The first was the 18th pick, and they took Goga Bitadze from Georgia. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. That was the 18th pick. And then with the 50th pick, they took a player by the name of Jarrell Brantley, and then promptly traded him to the Jazz for a 2021 second-round pick and cash. Obviously, NBA DraftNet had Bowen going to the Pacers at around about that pick, the sort of 50th, which was probably a bit high for Bowen, or seemed to be at that time. He was picked anywhere from sort of 50 to 60. The Pacers liked him. I believe they were one of the teams that sent a scout over to Sydney to check him out. Jeff talks about the amount of scouts that came out to Australia to see Bowen, and you know, the amount of money and investment that these teams make. But anyway, nonetheless, he then promptly signed that deal. Presumably, the Pacers really liked him, but weren't going to spend the 50th pick on him or had that trade in mind to free up a bit of cap space or what have you, but still liked him and have gone for him. And Ben Yamkadani of NBA Australia and SportingNews.com has come out with an article. It just says, Bowen, who played his high school basketball in Indiana, will spend the majority of the season with the Pacers G League affiliate, the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, who are the star of the NBA 2K19 My Career storyline. And it says, he was spending with the gym and can spend up to 45 days on the Pacers roster. So I don't know if there's a minimum to that. has to spend time on the actual NBA roster or if he's been signed to the G League affiliate. Either way, it shows that a team is interested and, you know, training camp will start, and whether you're taken first or 60th or not at all, the balls get rolled out and everybody's equal. And if you can earn playing time or show potential, you know, you're in with a chance. So my congratulations to Brian Bowen and really good luck. And I'll be watching him closely next season. It's no surprise to me that the Pacers took an interest. I thought he had very similar numbers to Terrence Ferguson, who was over here. I think his game was very similar to Ferguson's. I think maybe even a slightly better outside shooter, maybe not quite as good off the dribble, perhaps not quite as athletic. But they're the small holes in his game, but there were certainly no holes in his professionalism and in his potential. So I think the Pacers have done quite well. And good luck to him. That's about everything. I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Jeff Van Groningen. As always, follow me on Twitter at NBL Pocket Podcast. And if you're on iTunes and all that sort of stuff, subscribe so you get all the latest episodes downloaded immediately. I'm not mad about the way this episode came out sounding. You can hear Jeff just fine. He's coming through clear. It's my questions to him that are a bit faint, so I'm looking on ways to improve either the editing or equipment I've got to record these phone calls. If you're out there and you're in the audio tech sphere and you've got some suggestions, by all means, email me, nblpocketpodcast@gmail.com. So bear with the audio, but the answers are good, especially Jeff's.
I mean, I guess the other thing is, like, were you ever sort of really interested in getting a Chinese player, a high-profile one, over? Do you think that would be a method to get Chinese interest and Asian interest?
Well, we were. Yeah, well, we were for sure. And, of course, we were the first team at, you know, to enact the NBL's rule of using the foreign player rule to actually put a player into our roster, which we did in the first year of my three at the Kings. And, you know, that was Bo Liu. Now, in terms of the question about were we interested in a really, really high-level player, absolutely. But let's just use as a massive example the player Yi, who played in the NBA. Now, he would have been a sensation here, for sure. But to get him out of China, you'd be paying more than you would have paid, say, to an Andrew Bogut, because he's paid enormous amounts of money where he's playing in his own country. So, and likewise, the Philippines. I had a really close look at Filipino players, too. I long held an idea that, you know, to get the Filipino community engaged at the Kings would be a great thing. But again, the very good Filipino players, by definition, are really looked after in their league as local players in their league. So what you then have to do is you have to then sort of say, well, do we get a player that's still developing that could still engage the community? And that's what we did with Bo Liu, and that's what we did with Amritpal Singh, the Indian player.
Apparently thinking about making a comeback after doing the ACL.
Yeah, he's working really hard. And, yeah, so we worked hard to try to come up with those things. But in the case of a Chinese player who's a bona fide Chinese national-level player, a Yi or someone along those lines, that's a really, really expensive proposition. So to spend that type of money, you then have to ask yourself, is that of more value than a Jerome Randall or a Casper Ware or someone along those lines? And generally speaking, it's not. Now, Yi would have been, but he would have cost twice as much as a Casper Ware or a Jerome Randall as well. So it's a difficult one, but I think at some point, you know, there may be an interested enough player to actually say, well, I really want to do this and go and play in the NBL as a real challenge. It's a tough league. It's my next step to you know, see another part of the world and take on a really tough environment. But you really got to find that guy, and it's not quite as easy as you think, because if you put yourself in their shoes, would you leave your own country where you're getting, like, really handsomely paid just to say that you're a rotation player in the NBL? You know, so it's a tough one.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that.
But I think the rule is a terrific rule, and I don't want to give the wrong impression. Like, we enjoyed the experience of having Bo Liu and Amritpal Singh, and both those players actually did see a real uplift in interest in the Chinese and Indian communities, respectively. We had lots of media when we signed those players.
Indian
community? No, domestically. But in the case of Amritpal Singh, we actually had quite a bit of international interest. It did make India's number one paper. It was talked about in that paper. it was quite a big story in the region where he was from, which is obviously the Punjab region, just huge. And, you know, it was a really worthwhile situation. The other thing about it is that Andrew Gaze and myself did not believe in these guys being token-level signings. And although neither of them were ever going to be huge starters in the NBL, we looked at it as where we recruited them within the roster, were they at least as good as where we would have recruited someone else into that spot? And Amitrol Singh, for a guy that played 3 to 5, you know, maybe 6-7 minutes a game as an insurance policy player, was actually as good or better as anyone else we could have got for that money. Because bear in mind, the NBL is giving you a concession to get them. They're not counting them as a import. They're counting them as a local. And in the case of both those players, we paid them the minimum salary. So if Amitrol Singh is not the equal of most 7-footers, because he's a big unit, a minimum salary 7-footer, I would argue to this day that he did a good job as a minimum salary 7-footer. So we only looked at the recruitment of those players to be commensurate to what we were paying them.
Right, I understand. Yeah, it makes sense when you think about it that way. Let's change gear. The NBA draft has just finished. Obviously, and unfortunately, Brian Bowen hasn't been taken. My question to you, Jeff, is did you ever speak to him about his contingency if he wasn't to be drafted?
No, I didn't, and it was a really interesting day watching that draft. And, I'm disappointed for him and his people, his family and his agent that today didn't pan out that way. It just shows the tremendous depth of talent that is out there, that 60 picks went by and no team was able to pull him in. Just as an aside, we had 16 NBA teams send out personnel during the season, so it was more than half the league that actually touched down in Sydney and watched Brian Bowen's near play, physically came, and some as high as general manager level and others just head of scouting and others just scouts. And so it shows you the enormous amount of research that goes into players. Even a player that ultimately didn't end up getting drafted today had half the league send people literally halfway across the world to scout. It's a big exercise. And so you've got to then say, they did that with every one of the other 60 that ended up being drafted too. So these are enormous operations. These are enormous front offices with incredible resources. And for one reason or another today, it didn't happen for Brian, and he'll find another way, and whether that's G League or playing overseas again or whatever that may be. In terms of your question, none of us spoke to him specifically about it because his aim was to play the season, return to the NBA draft process, go through the workouts, which he did, and try to be drafted. So they'd be now coming up through, you know, his agent and his people around him would now be strategizing what the next step is. And it's worth bearing in mind that many good players do not end up being drafted and still eke out a really solid professional career. I would be expecting to see him at Summer League when I head over in a couple of weeks, which I always do, and see what's out there. And I would think he'll be hooking onto a Summer League roster somewhere to try to get in front of the same people that have had an initial look at him, and it gives them a further look. And maybe that's what he needs, more time in front of the right people, more questions that he can answer them through his play. And that's you know, evidently what's going to need to be his path now. Perhaps the G League will be a really good option for him. Or maybe he'll look at coming back to an international destination, but I'm not sure.
That was my next question. So under the next slide, and I hope I'm not retreading old territory because I have listened to your interview on Aussie Hoopla, but with his Rising Star contract, can he not be drafted and return as a Rising Star, or would he come back as an import?
Well, it's unprecedented because we were the first to actually engage an ex-Stars player. So that's for the Sydney Kings and the NBL now to look at. But what I do know is that he was contracted to the Sydney Kings for 2 years. So that contract was there for 2 years. So something now between the NBL, the Sydney Kings, and whatever other team may be interested in him would need to be worked out. Yep, because otherwise, as it stands, he is still a contracted Sydney Kings player for the next year. Had he been drafted, the NBA team that drafted him would have needed to work that out with the NBL. That's part of the process that's up to the NBL and the team that would be interested. How that played out would really be up to Jeremy Lowlieger to work with that team. But under the terms of the Next Stars program, he does have a 2-year deal with the Sydney Kings, and so to be released in that second year would have required the discussion, and whatever considerations were made would have been an NBL call. So.
Okay. Oh, interesting. My next question then is, I remember on that interview you said that Bowen had other interests from other clubs before you signed him to the Rising Star.
Yep.
How does that process work as far as, like, so you say we're looking after Bowen. I've heard the conversation. You literally called Jeremy Lowlieger and you guys almost had the same thought at the same time.
Yeah.
So then do you literally pick up the phone and say, hello, Perth Wildcats, I'm looking at Brian Bowen, we have this scouting report, and you turn over all your sort of scouting report and evidence and everything? Or is it, what's that conversation?
No, we didn't. I think the point that has been made is that through the Next Stars program, had other clubs been interested in Brian Bowen Jr., they could have also asked the NBL for permission to talk and sign and to try to sign Brian Bowen Jr. But ultimately, it's still a situation where a player has to want to go to a club. And so the point that I made on that previous interview was we recruited Bowen Jr. in the same way as we would have recruited an import. We showed him why we thought Sydney would be the destination for him, what we were doing as a club, how our coaching structure worked, how he would fit into the team and the whole club. So in the end, we treated it as a recruitment process. To get to your point, if the Perth Wildcats or Cairns Taipans or anybody else had been interested in Bowen Jr., my understanding is that there were a couple of clubs that did inquire to the NBL and said, well, what about us with Bowen Jr.? They were also free to talk to both the NBL and Bowen Jr. and his agent about their interest, and my understanding is they did. But ultimately, a player has to want to go somewhere, and they have to make that decision. So in the end, in our case, we felt like we put up a really strong case, and Bowen Jr. and his people agreed. But that's how it worked last year. Now, understand this as well, that we were the first, and it was the first time in the Next Stars sort of situation had ever been rolled out. This latest couple of guys with RJ Hampton and Melon Ball, that's phase two of the process, and Jeremy has presided over that process. And what mechanisms have occurred between the NBL and those clubs concerned is not something that I'm privy to, because those are arrangements between the NBL and those clubs. But my assumption is that both of those players would again be contracted for a couple of years, that again the plan would be that they would be drafted, which I think in both those players' cases it's highly likely that they will be. And then the New Zealand Breakers and the NBL, and in the case of the Hawks and the NBL, will be worked through the process of any team that wants to take an X-Stars program player. They would have to make those arrangements with the NBL. That if they draft those players, which again I'm assuming they will, someone will draft them, then they'll need to make those arrangements. And I think that's a terrific, smart move by the NBL to say, look, we have essentially contracted these players to our league for a couple of years. Yep. And then the draft process happens, and if discussions need to happen, they can happen.
That's what I thought. And as far as I understand with the Next Star, there's been a huge quote on Hampton's sort of contract price, anywhere from $500,000 upwards. Is that sort of contract, that's paid by the NBL?
Well, the NBL, again, I'm speaking about our situation in Sydney, so I'm not across how the NBL would have done the deal with RJ Hampton and Melo Ball and those clubs. But yes, the NBL has put it on the record that they preside over the Next Stars program. Jeremy Lowlieger and Larry Kisselman came up with the idea of the concessions for a club in the sense that they're not counted as an import. The club has responsibilities to put the player up, to pay the costs around the player when they live in that city. So they are provided accommodation by the team, and they're integrated as if an NBL import was coming in. You're treating them the same way. You're flying them in. You're making sure that you've put those logistical arrangements in place, giving them a car to drive, a place to live. So they're really like an NBL import in the sense that all those things that you're treating them, you know, to make sure they're integrated into your team, they are in place. But in terms of the contract, the Next Dash program is an NBL program. It's a Jeremy and Larry-led program, as well as their office, their front office staff. It's a very creative and very brilliant scheme, I think, that has ended up seeing the NBL talked about on some of ESPN's basketball programs.
Second year.
Yeah, it's second year, and it's now got itself a couple of bona fide first-round draft prospects, possibly even first 15-type pick prospects. And that's in place. So the arrangements to do with how that contract would work is all in the NBL's hands, and I'm a huge proponent of the program. I think that what Jeremy and Larry have done with it is brilliant. The specifics of the program around those things that are being thrown around money-wise, and that's the nature of the media. They like to throw figures around, and only Jeremy would know those figures. If they're close or if you're a mile off, that there'd be questions for him. But as a principle, it should be and is the NBL's domain that they own the Next Dash program. They put it together, and they certainly are in charge of the contracting of it.
Yeah. What was I about to say? Stars. What do you like about the program, quite simply?
Well, I think it's actually fulfilling a need that exists for a certain amount of players that are in that gap between high school and the pros. And I think what it's done is it's been the NBL in a very nimbly and adaptive way coming up with a program in seriously quick speed over the last couple of years that says, look, if you were thinking that college, the NCAA route, wasn't for you, we have an alternative for you. And we have a very good alternative for you. You get to be a professional player in a tough league, play against men, be treated well, but also have to test yourself against real competition. All of those things are what you get out of it as a player if you're RJ Hampton or Brian Bowen Jr. or Melo Ball. Excuse me. What we get out of it as a league is we get the interest and the following. In the case of Ball, a massive following at that from social media and regular media. In the case of Hampton, a genuine number 10 prospect or within the top 10 type prospect. What the league gets out of it is clear. It gets PR and positive exposure about how good the league is. And if I had a dollar now for every time in the last 2 or 3 weeks, NBA commentators have actually noted that, hey, this is a tough league that they're going to. The NBL route is no joke. Now, that type of real, substantive, positive feedback about your league is worth its weight in gold. And that's why I think what they've done with it and how they've put this in place is to be applauded. It's been a very, very good move by them, and I think it's been creative. And, you know, I think it's a wonderful thing for our league.
With Bowen, did you see an uptick? I don't know what metrics you had available to you, but did you see an uptick in watch or viewership, if that's a word, viewership over in the United States? Did you see an uptick in actual consumption of the NBL?
Well, we didn't. We weren't privy to numbers across agencies in the NBA, for example. I mean, I'm not across those numbers. What I can tell you is that we got inquiries and media coverage that we would never have had it not been for Bowen Jr. being with us. So we a little bit like a much smaller version of what happened with Hampton, but when Bowen Jr. announced that he was going to the NBL and to play for the Sydney Kings with Andrew Bogut and under Andrew Gaze and so forth, that was a story in many, many circles at the time, because he was being followed very closely. He'd been involved in a very high-profile sort of fallout out of the college system. And so it was newsworthy. And people for the first time said, goodness, this is a guy that's actually chosen to play in Australia as his next step to try to get drafted. So certainly aware of the numbers in terms of how many interview requests and things we had. It was numerous.
Do you think that the league has seen an increase in sort of import interest as a result? You know, I mean, just the flow and effect of, Hampton and Ball are going there, credibility of the league, it's come down. I mean, we saw where LaMelo Ball signed, and then Aaron Brooks, who shares the same agent as LaMelo Ball, signed within the week. Did you see? Yeah. Did you get any more interest from established import of talent?
I don't think established import talent would have been sort of influenced by Bowen Jr. signing at the Kings in our case. I mean, we had Andrew Bogut who committed. That was probably far more substantial in terms of what led to people having a look at us. And the Kings have always been a destination anyway because it's a well-known city. It's a beautiful city and it's got a long-established reputation of being a place that would be good to play in, to be honest. And a lot of people like to have a go at Sydney about 100 things, but it's pretty difficult to deny that over the years they've had no problem in bringing in well-qualified imports, well-qualified coaches, a lot of interest. So no, I don't think the Bowen recruitment led to some sort of uptick for us in imports falling over themselves to play. And to be honest, I don't think LaMelo Ball at Illawarra Hawks was anything to do with why Brooks signed per se. I think you're probably a little bit more on the mark when you say they're both represented by the same agent. And I think that agent would have been talking to the Hawks and probably it was a logical thing to shop some of his other players to them. Yeah, so when you get familiar with people, those conversations tend to happen more. And the agent probably thought, well, this will be good for LaMelo. LaMelo will have a veteran guy next to him. And it sort of helps almost fireproof that young player in the eyes of the agent. In the eyes of the agent, he's just made life a little bit easier for his own young client by bringing a veteran client in. But I don't think it's a case of the Illawarra Hawks signed LaMelo Ball and all of a sudden Brooks would have fallen over himself to say, well, I'd like to park myself next to him. It's more to do with who represents them both, and that's probably more like it. But in terms of the long-term effect or the medium to long-term effect that it has for the NBL as a destination in terms of whether it's an import or a young player or an Australian, a young Australian at college, saying, heck, is this a place that I would like to play? Well, I think it has a tremendous positive effect because it shows that the league is on the move. It shows that the league is doing creative, positive, dynamic things, and I think that can only help, in the minds of potential players who want to look at playing there.
I was about to say, with the rising stars, do you have to be foreign-born? Like, I'm thinking about a guy like, say, a Josh Green, had he not committed to college. I think he's at Arizona.
You'd have to check with Jeremy Loliga on that, but I wouldn't think that you have to be a foreign-born player. If you were a genuine... What Jeremy was concerned about right the way through with this program is, are they a genuine draft prospect? I would think that an Australian genuine draft prospect could still fit the bill, but that would be a question for the NBL.
Because, I mean, you think about it, years ago, the sort of blueprint is a Joe Ingles, who went from the AAS to the South Dragons and then bounced around a little bit onto the NBA and is now, a long-standing person of that
level. And as you said, maybe a Josh Green or, another player that might be coming down the pipe in the next couple of years. I would be very surprised if the NBL wasn't interested in them also being here. I mean, even more so, they're Australians coming back to Australia and then hopefully getting drafted. And we saw what happened with a veteran Australian coming back and playing NBL and then coming straight back into the NBL, from the NBL into the NBA for the finals, which was Bogut. And we saw that the mainstream media coverage of that was massive. And, I would think that the way the NBL tilt themselves towards growing the league, making sure that people know how dynamic it is, I'd see no reason why an Australian NBA draft prospect wouldn't be considered in the same light. But I don't know that it's actually referenced in the rules.
Okay. Yeah, I'll either speak to Jeremy or have a look through the write-up of it, the actual seriousness of the Rising Stars. One thing I had was, obviously, Andrew Bogut played his last game. I think there was about almost a year's break between his last NBA game and his first game with the Kings. Aaron Brooks is now coming off a huge gap of almost 2 years, 535 or something. I did the maths later on, but I've forgotten. What did you do with Andrew, with Bogut, to make sure that he was in good shape? Did he have a different kind of... How do you get a player ready for NBL basketball after such a break?
Well, it's a really good question, and to be brutally honest, it wasn't us that got him ready. It was him that got him ready. So he was religiously tuned into his Pilates and other conditioning programs from pretty much day one. That well, I'm sure it was before we signed him, because he was getting ready to play somewhere. But he took charge of that. Once the players came together as a group in the preseason, well, he obviously participated fully in all that everyone else did as well. But he was onto it way earlier than that, because he recognised those points that you're talking about. He knows his body best, and he knew he hadn't played for a while, and he got himself ready, and we could see the results on the floor, and he won the MVP of the league. So, you know, that was all credit to him. But he did participate in, obviously, everything that we did as well, but he was well onto that before he even came into our preseason camp.
Let's say he was born just at Kings, and Aaron Brooks, agent, taps you on the shoulder and says, "I've got a player. He's got great NBA credentials. He has been out of the game 2 years." What would you have a hesitance there, or would you be quite confident, or how would you make the decision to sign him?
Well, I think the only way you can answer that is, who else do you have on your roster? With a Jerome Randle or Casper Ware already on the roster, then I think, you know, that's a different thing, and you don't need to investigate that sort of 34, 35 year old veteran NBA situation. Now, if Jerome had have gone and Casper Ware wasn't available, and you couldn't get, say, a Melo Trimble, then of course you'd look at it. But I would have tended to go the way that we did with Randle, or the way they've done with Ware, or the way Dean Vickerman has with Melo Trimble, because all things being equal, a gap of a couple of years isn't ideal. And you know, bringing in a veteran guy who hasn't played for a while could be a bit of a challenge. Bogut showed that it wasn't, but he's a pretty extraordinary human being in terms of his readiness. The professionalism around him is you know, top notch. Now, Aaron Brooks may be every bit of that, but I don't know Aaron Brooks, so I have no idea. But I think, again, if you were sitting there at a loose end and you did not know what you were going to do for your import spot, and a bona fide NBA quality guard, which Brooks is, was making himself available, and you didn't have one of those guys that we just mentioned a minute ago, of course you'd be looking at it. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's roll things right back a little bit. So, Jeff, I've looked you up on Wikipedia. You don't have a Wikipedia page. Is that by design, or you just...
I certainly haven't. I wouldn't even be aware of that.
So, because obviously a lot of the NBL is sort of very unwritten. There's not encyclopedias each year and things like that. Your first start in basketball. Maybe you've answered this before, but if so, I haven't found it anywhere. Where did that all begin?
In NBL basketball?
Let's go. No. In general, like.
Well, my start, like most people that are in the industry, I guess, was playing, and I played right through as a junior. We moved to the country here in Australia from the United States when I was young, and I played through the Victorian country system. I was lucky enough to represent Country Vic a couple of times, but I was always on the edge of that. I wasn't a lock pick at any point. It was just something that I love doing. I love playing, and you know, same thing as the old Siebel competition. I never really played Siebel, but I was lucky enough to play some summer Siebel for the Sunbury Jets, and I was around that region between Melbourne and Bendigo was where I did most of my growing up, and so I was a player. But the difference, I guess, for me is that I diverted off that path fairly early when I recognised that it probably wasn't going to be a top of the tree situation for me, as much as I love playing. And I went into coaching very, very young, and I started running basketball camps and clinics right throughout the state of Victoria. I was running camps and clinics with people like Daryl McDonald and Art Copeland, Andrew Gaze, Bruce Bolden, as a 19-year-old, 18-year-old, running a business. And taking those guys to places that normally didn't see them. So we were going to Mildura, to Kerrang, to Hamilton, Horsham, and these Victorian places that didn't usually see the players, but were seeing them on television, because back then it was on 10, and Carfino and Woods had a show on, and yeah, it was actually quite big. So what I found as a business model is these guys were seen, but not actually seen in those local communities. So I took it on myself to come up with a business, which was called Jump Shot Promotions, and many people do this now, but back then it wasn't really done the way I had done it, and that is to actually form it and base it around a well-known star. And what it did for me was two things. First of all, they were really successful. And I've told the story before that my very first big clinic was actually with Lenard Copeland when he was still at the Tigers, before I even had a chance to go and work at the Tigers, because I did that at a later stage and ran the Tigers. But this was well before that. And I remember, and I used to play at the old Albert Park on Fridays and Saturdays, and that's when all those guys were down there playing the Friday afternoon jungle ball, and they were fantastic days that a lot of people reminisce about today. And anyway, long story short, I got to know Lenard from that Albert Park sort of era. And I had approached Lenard and said, I want to do this big clinic out of a place called Horsham, which he had never heard of. And it is. It was well before, it was probably before Mitch Creek was born. But it is. And I said to him, look, I've got this idea, and will you do it with me? And he said, yep, no problem. If there's a few bucks involved, I said, no worries, we'll give you some cash. And anyway, we came out to Horsham. But to give you an idea of how this thing took off, it was blistering hot because at that stage the NBL played in the winter, so this was off-season. This was the summer, which was the middle of the off-season. And we drove all the way out there, which was like 4 hours, 3.5 hours from Melbourne, I think, from memory. It was a long way. And I had no idea who would show up because I had pre-promoted it. I had the local association under it. When I told them coming to town, every kid's going to have a chance to get items. And I had it all worked out that I was bringing this sort of, this whole model out to the kids would get a show bag of gear, meet an NBL star, get some coaching, both from local coaches and Lenard. And I'd run it, no idea how many would show up. And we pulled into Horsham in the middle of a 40-degree day. And the stadium, from my recollection, was not too far from the pool. Every place has a local pool out there. And Lenard saw all these kids lined up, and we were getting near the stadium. And he said, Jen, I think there's going to be a lot more kids than maybe you think at this clinic. And I said, no, look, don't get too excited. I think they're probably all lined up for the pool. And, it's 40 degrees out there. And they weren't. They were all lined up to see him at the Jumpstart Promotions Clinic. There was 370 kids that day. And they were all paying cash at the door. And I worked out pretty quickly, this is a bit of a business model here. And if I can actually take, this might work. And if we can take Gaze and Copeland and Bolden, and I did it with so many clients. I mean, Darryl McDonald loved doing them, and we did a lot of clinics. So we went out into those regions and places that were close enough to drive, albeit they were long drives, but far enough away that they would not normally get to an NBL game. Yeah. That was the model. So, well, I don't know who does it now, and I'm up in Brisbane now, and I've been running NBL clubs and doing other things, so I don't know. But back then, it worked really, really well. And I ran about 40 to 50 of those, I guess, over a two-year period. And it really took off. And what it did for me was twofold. Number one, it was a really successful business. And for a young guy, it provided more money than I anticipated. And it was a really successful thing. And I was also pretty good at keeping names and addresses and phone numbers, and that allowed me to, at a later stage, start running NBA trips with these same guys. So I started writing to those that had competed in my events or participated in my events, and I started offering them the chance to come over to NBA trips that I was running, and I've run basically an NBA trip every year since now, 95, I think. I still do them now. So
you take Australian kids over there?
I take anybody, not just kids, parents and kids, to go and actually watch NBA games and be escorted by me, and we meet players, we meet coaches, and I just do it as a fan trip. So the clinics and camps morphed into not just clinics and camps, but also tours. The whole Jumpstart Promotions thing got pretty successful and pretty big. And as I said, that was one thing that it did. But the second thing that it did is I got to know everybody.
Yeah, sure.
I got to know every one of those Victorian guys that were either in Melbourne, Geelong, because Geelong had an NBL club, one of the four Melbourne teams, because there was four down there at the time. There was five teams in Victoria at that time. There was Geelong and the four NBL clubs. So I just got to be, known within the ranks. And coming out of that, one of those clubs, which was the Geelong Supercats, actually offered me a job as an assistant coach, and I was the youngest assistant coach in the league at 23 years old. So that's how I started. And coming out of Geelong, I eventually made my way to Melbourne. I ended up as a GM at the Melbourne Tigers at 29 when Grant Cadee left to take the Sydney Kings job.
How old is Tommy Greer in comparison?
Tommy's older than that. He's getting on now, Tommy. But, I would think so. But Tom's doing a great job. But, he's another young one. But I was obscenely young and looked even younger. And I ran the Tigers. And then the big break for me, really, was that was obviously a huge break for me. But Lindsay and Andrew showed me some trust to say, look, would you come and do that after Grant left? And I wasn't there all that long in that top job because the Brisbane Bullets came knocking and asked me to come and run their club. And they wanted to very much formulate, I guess, a club based around a lot of the values that the Melbourne Tigers had. Consistency, a family-based club, a good group of people. So I went up there and we revamped the front office, we revamped the roster. The first year was very, very difficult because we had to basically release a lot of players that weren't quite there. I had to release a coach. I brought Joey Wright in.
Remember where you're at, but when you do let a player go, like you've seen that scene in Moneyball where it's like, you know, hey, get rid of a player, you just, you know.
Yeah.
If I may, when you're making that decision, what's your sort of MO?
In terms of the discussion?
Yeah, in the discussion.
Well, it's just the most difficult thing that anyone in the sport has to do, and you try your best. Yeah, well, if you're in, I guess, the city where they're actually still there, I think it's very important to catch up with them face-to-face. Sometimes you don't have that luxury because they may have gone somewhere straight after the season by the time you make your decision or whatever, but generally speaking, it should be something that you sit down, have a good chat. And look, some of those discussions are really, really difficult. And the toughest one for me was in Brisbane, letting go of Benny Castle, who was a terrific player. And he's one of my better friends to this day. And there was a period of time probably after we had to make that move and he went off and played at the Hawks and luckily did continue his career for quite some time. But at the time, he didn't know if he was going to get that opportunity. He was really, really disappointed. And it puts a strain on guys, especially if you know each other well and you respect each other. But those things, if they're handled the best way possible, I think can come back around. Simon Crean was another one. I really, both myself and the Bullets owner loved Simon. But the decision was made probably a year before Simon was thinking, or maybe even 2 years before Simon probably thought he was finished. We made the decision to let Simon go. And again, Simon, I run into Simon now, and Simon's a terrific bloke who I just think is an unbelievable person. Now, I just think those things can come around if you've tried your best. And I think most athletes understand that you're sometimes in a position where you have to make that call. And it's not easy, and you don't always get it right, but you do your best with it.
And you were saying, so you went to Brisbane, they're looking to do a club, and you're pushing forward. Keep going from there. Sorry to take
yep, so... Yep, so the pivotal point at Brisbane was bringing in Joey Wright after the previous coach had dropped the first 10 games of the season, so we were 0-10. And I just felt with Joey, having known him in other settings previously, and he'd never coached. In fact, at the time, he was coaching at a high school in Texas, so he's completely untried at the professional level. But sometimes there's guys that you feel are just leaders. And so I brought Joey in, and Joey and I worked really hard to rebuild that club.
Did he pitch you with like a PowerPoint presentation, or does he just come in?
No, I called him and asked him if he could coach the team.
It's that simple.
Yep. There was no PowerPoint. He wasn't lobbying. I called him and I had spoken to Simon Crean about it, wondered where he was, because Simon had stayed in touch with Johnny after they played together at Geelong.
Right.
So Simon was involved in that from the standpoint of I was testing Simon about, hey, you know, is Joey around? What's he doing? And because I had lost touch with him a little bit, so Simon Simon was an important one to just sort of say, just to try to get in touch with Joey. And Simon had said, look, you know, if you're thinking about getting Joey involved, I think it'd be a great thing. But really, it was an offhander at that stage to just say, well, let's just check him out. And I gave him a call, and you know, we had a really good conversation, and I called him back and said, I want you to come over and coach. And he got on the plane and came and coached. And to give you an idea, that first season was a really, really tough situation where we released so many players that we felt were probably not quite right for the Bullets at that point.
What year would that have been?
That would have been the 2001-2 season or 2002 season, 01-02. And we released imports, local players, and at one point, Rob Sibley, who hadn't played for a couple of, maybe 3 or 4 years, he'd been retired, he had a bad knee, he actually came out of the front office to fill a roster spot for us because we felt at least he was committed to the Bullets. There was a lot of guys we didn't feel were, and that was a year that a lot of people probably understandably forget about. It was a bad one. And but Joey got them going. He won, I think, maybe 5 of his first 8, and then we picked up another couple at the end of the season. I can't remember exactly, but for a team that had started 0-10, it salvaged some respectability. But from the next season, it all changed, and we never missed the top 4 from then, and it culminated in the 2007 championship, which still holds records for margin of victory through the year. The TAB took us off the betting boards, and the TAB took them off the betting boards. They kept beating the spreads. There was all sorts of things happening, and it was just a really good period. So that's the nutshell of what happened. And then obviously, and I spent a little bit of time with Network 10 commentating games. I ran a tournament, and then I got back into the Sydney Kings when Harvey Lister brought the team.
What I wanted to talk to you about as well, obviously we've got a new team coming in, Southeast Melbourne Phoenix.
Yep.
Growth of the league looks good. I don't know if you had a chance to look over the new CBA yet or just get the sort of nutshell synopsis of the changes. What are you liking about the look of the growth, or do you have any scepticisms or any sort of concerns or worries or anything like that?
No, I don't have any scepticism about the league because the league's in good hands with Larry Kesselman and Jeremy Lowlieger. I think that I can honestly say, hand on heart, I don't think the league lacks any dynamism, creativity, or anything else. There's no scepticism at all. What there is there's challenges which all of the people in the front office to a man would say we recognize them. And the challenges are in the form of other sports with money, other sports with big TV deals that are maybe legacy deals that were signed 5 and 6 years ago before the landscape changed. Because let me tell you, the landscape has changed for the way TV deals are done. And so there are sports that have lived off resources that the NBL has never been privy to, never had a chance to have, and I'd argue are fully deserving of. If you look at the A-League, you know, signed a deal when it rebranded, but in my opinion was not commensurate for the league for what it was, because the NBL to me, the disproportionate. And our league, our NBL league, I think is a better league. now I'm biased in saying that because I've been in the industry forever, but goodness me, if you could give Larry Kesselman, you know, $10, $15, $20, $30 million, you know, as a deal, let alone some of these really, really obscenely high deals, this league would do even more. But without it, it's had to create its own path, and it's done it very, very well. So I'm not skeptical about the future. I'm not in any way doubtful about what we can do as a league, but we have massive challenges because there are some money leagues around, and there is also the perception is also a very interesting thing. And if you listen to or read papers, you would think, for example, the NRL. Now, I had a chance to work at the Broncos for a couple of years here in Brisbane, and I respect them as an organisation immensely. But being an exception, if you look at across the board the NRL clubs, you know, you could go to Brookvale in Sydney on a wet day, and there might be 8,000 people there. But the NRL is still dominating the back pages of the Daily Telegraph on a regular basis. Now we had 15,000 people at our playoff game against Melbourne United at Qdos Bank Arena, and 3 times during the year we had close to 10,000, and 1 time we had 11,000, all in the space of about a season at Qdos Bank Arena. So the people were voting with their feet in Sydney, And across the road at ANZ Stadium, sometimes there was, you know, 10,000 people in a sport that's blessed with huge money, massive headlines on the tabloids every day. And so my point is that I think that's the challenge we face, is that the perception is that the AFL and NRL are monolithic, and in many ways they are. But our sport has huge participation. It has amazing creativity and dynamism.
One third of people are invested in basketball in some way, shape, or form, playing, watching, or both.
Yep, and we have 350 to 400 million people up in our neighbour in China that nominate basketball as their number one sport. And the thing that we do have that the NRL and AFL can never have is we have the international presence. So we have this chance to compete for gold medals in Olympic competition. We also have something that is very unique, which is, you know, 13 people at some point in the last NBA season played NBA competition and were Australian. And that's an amazing pathway that we can offer through our sport. If you play in the AFL and you reach the highest zenith in your sport, you're playing AFL, which is great. Great. Love the sport. It's a fantastic sport. But you're not going to make the NBA or compete for an Olympic medal. So my point is that I think we've still got a long way to go in terms of the media recognizing how big this thing is, but it's not for lack of trying. And we've come a long way because now we do have some back page presence at times, and we do have Andrew Bogut getting huge headlines when he goes back to the NBA, and we do have players regularly showing up on the project or Fox Sports or all that type of thing. So we had it. We have it in numbers that we never used to have it, but we don't have it in the numbers that even go anywhere near an AFL or NRL. And we should. We should, because our league is that good. It really is.
That competition between the both. There sort of is this schism in the NBL, or this major lightning bolt moment in 1998 when it decides to go from winter to summer. And you talk about perception, and also in a way of perception, I think we're also talking about momentum. The sport was building, and then for whatever reason, it just kind of didn't do very well. And then in that sort of middle 2000s, you know, was rather poorly. Your thought on winter versus summer, and then that loss of momentum and that weird period of the NBA?
Well, there's two things that, in my opinion, there's two points that are very distinct. There's what happened in 97 when they made the change, and there's whether we should change now. And in my opinion, they're not related anymore because it's been so long, okay? Historically, to give you a very, very quick history lesson, because I was very close to that situation, okay? And I know a lot of people that were in the NBL at that point, and I was administrating a club. That change was, in my opinion, a mistake. The change from winter to summer was a mistake, and it was done in a hurried, non-considered way, and it was done essentially because on a half a smell of a whiff of a promise that they would end up on Network 7 as the nominated summer sport to offset AFL, they scrambled and they let a very good network deal with 10. Yeah. They treated it with contempt, okay? Now, I can say all of that safely. There's nobody involved in the NBL that was anywhere near that deal, okay? There, none of them are there. There's not even any relationship to what was the administration at the time. But that was a very, very poorly thought through or even not thought through situation. And it caused one of the networks, which was 10, to have a disinterest, if not disdain, in the NBL for a very, very, very long time. Okay, so it was a mistake, and the mechanics of it don't really matter now, but they were there and they were poorly thought out, and it did cause a drama. So in the end, they ended up in summer, and they had to make a fist of it in summer, and they not only didn't have 10 anymore, but despite thinking they would get 7, they didn't get them. So they then were in the wilderness of media coverage for a long time. And that's when they bounced around and didn't have great deals. Got to Fox eventually, but Fox was very, very minor at the point at that time because not many people had yet taken it up, so it was different than now. And so it was not a major player in the landscape. so they bounced around. So we can put that to the side and say wasn't the right decision. But in terms of the changing it now, you've now got a you've now got an owner that's invested in what this league looks like to a record degree. He has put enormous resources into this, and if you asked me 5 years ago when the league was still bumping around, I'd have said perhaps you look at changing it back. But it was at its lowest ebb, and Larry hadn't entered the fray and really got a hold of it. With the way he's done it now, and with what Jeremy and his team are doing now, I think it's, if it's something that they felt strategically could work to make the change, I would fall in and support it. But I think that it's probably more an answer, Joseph, to do things like look at the length of the season, look at other things that occur in the off season, look at ways of integrating with other leagues around the world in the off season. I think there's other ways now of saying we can have a presence at other times of the year, but I don't think that a simple approach to just say, well, if we just moved it back to winter now, it would just be so much better. I don't know that that's really going to be the answer. And therefore, I would not make the mistake of just going on a whim. I'd actually try to build the product, which they're doing. They're building it very, very well.
Did you ever get an indication from Kesselman and that they were like, we are progressing this summer, we are very confident, or are they very much a, we'll see what happens type of people?
No, I think that the way they've approached the task of rebuilding the league, in my opinion, looking at it, would indicate that they're committed to this time. But they've also shown, whether it's through the Next Dive program or any number of marketing initiatives, that they're very, very nimble. So they move, they adjust. And so I think that if some case was presented to say, well, what about this in the off-season? Or should we have a look at a shorter season to get ourselves maybe out of the way of this particular event, or to take this time slot, maybe own this time slot a little bit more? I think you'd find that they are listeners to that. But I think your answer in terms of have they ever really thought about moving, I mean, I'm sure they've thought about everything that could help their sport. But in the end, the fact that they're here where they are would suggest to me that they feel this is where we need to be for the time being, and we go from there. But I, as you can tell, I'm an unabashed cheerleader for what they're doing as a league. I think that anybody...
The growth is there, the exposure is there, the numbers are up.
Yeah.
It's very easy to be a fan, but yeah, you're very right.
And the only thing that I think is holding it back is not the administration of the NBL. It's long-standing, long-held beliefs in some traditional circles that somehow the sport sort of belongs as a, well, it's not quite the NRL and not quite the AFL, but I think they're missing it because it is. The league is. The league is excellent. And if we had...
Yeah, I understand.
It is. And if the league had, for example, I think ultimately, an optimum number would probably be one to two more teams. And I'm sure that at some point we'll grow again. But I think the league needs a couple more teams, a little bit more representation across the country to get it there, whether that's a Hobart or a Canberra or both. But I think we need a little bit more.
It's the most fun.
Perhaps, but it's a notoriously hard place to make a team work of any ilk. But I think that in the end, those things are strategy plays that the league would be very aware of. I think that those are the challenges, growing the league in a sustainable way. But the main challenges I keep banging on about is to say changing the perceptions of the traditional media buyers and media decision makers to go, hang on, this is right under our nose, and it is a damn good product. Yeah. I mean, we've watched these games, they are high level, it's entertaining, they're well run.
If you're just a guy who just likes, a guy or girl, who likes betting on things, well, this is a perfect thing to bet on. It's fun, it's quick, it's fast.
There's never a
game that makes sense. If you're an AFL watcher or a soccer fan, you'll get basketball aesthetic, and you'll be able to make an informed betting decision, and everything's good with a bet on it, Jeff.
And the other thing about our sport is it's incredibly clean. Touch wood, there's not been scandals in this sport for a very, very long time. There really hasn't ever been a sport that's considered to be a scandal-ridden sport. If you took scandals out of some of the football codes, you'd lose 30% of the copy in the papers. And we don't have that problem as a sport. So there's a lot going for it, and I just think that it's a war to continue to fight to say, we're here, we're not going anywhere, we're a great product, we're innovative, we send players to the best league in the world, they come back, they want to be here. It's a terrific thing. I just think we're seeing on an asset that is not quite fully recognised yet, but the league is doing everything it can to be recognised. And that's why this, just getting back to where we started, come the full circle. What the Next Dive program does with RJ Hampton and LaMelo Ball, for example, it actually just brings a microscope onto your league. It makes people have a second look at the league and think, hang on a minute, are you telling me that a kid that could go to Duke University, like RJ, could go to Duke University, he's chosen to come and play for New Zealand. Come to play for New Zealand. And LaMelo Ball and all that comes with it has chosen to come and play in New South Wales at the Illawarra Hawks. This is stuff that brings huge focus onto our league. So it's a terrific story.
I agree. I'll ask you one last question, then I'll let you go, Jeff. You've been very kind with the time. Let's go back to the here and now. So the date now is late June. What would NBA, if you were, when you were there with the Kings and that, what is a general manager doing at this time of year? How are you scouting? What are you doing?
Well, certainly the NBA Summer League coming up on July the 5th is a huge part of most NBA clubs' calendars now, particularly if they haven't filled out their import spots, which most clubs have not fully finished their import spots yet. So most GMs right now would be working with their coaches on completing the rosters, looking at overseas events like the Summer League to get a look at who's out there, working the phones with agents. They'd be hearing from agents incessantly. It's Groundhog Day this time of year. You'd be getting 8 or 9 calls a day, or certainly I did, from NBA agents, player agents pushing their players. You're going through all of that. It depends on the structure of the club. I was in charge of recruiting at any place that I was, and at Brisbane and Sydney, I was the sign-off. So now some GMs are leaving a lot of that to their coaches in a more wholesale way, and just signing off ultimately on the money. But in my case, we had an NBA-type structure where I was the head of basketball, so I was involved in all of that. And I think that, by the way, just as an aside, I think that that's the way the league will eventually go. I think Brisbane's moving a bit to that model. I think it was Matt Walsh in New Zealand. You know, he's a basketball guy. Yep, and AFL is that way. Premier League soccer is that way. Ultimately, the coach has a great deal to do coaching a team. If you look at the NBA today, today's draft was all about the GMs and front offices making those calls. The coaches will coach who they end up with. And so I think ultimately that's the way we'll go. But strangely in the NBL, that actually hasn't been the case. I was really the first one to kind of do it that I'm aware of, to back at Brisbane, to say, well, hang on, I don't think you can run as the core of your product basketball and not be a basketball person running the club. So I think that's just my philosophy for it. But in terms of the answer to your question, yes, they're working through the player recruitment. Those GMs that are much more across everything, including the commercials of the operation, they're obviously signing sponsors, they're working on membership, they're overseeing the commercial operations. But again, at Sydney, I, especially in that last year, I had really just removed myself from the commercials and was strictly running the basketball department, which in our case with Bogut, Gaze, Randall, Newley, Bowen, was a pretty big department, and so it had a lot of moving parts and a lot of things that we needed to make sure we did well and tried to be as professional as possible. So that's what you're doing if you're a basketball GM this time of year.
And what's Summer League like? Do you have fun at Summer League? Do you see all the NBL guys there as well? Is it sort of a competitive environment?
Yeah, it is. It's a collegiate environment. You're seeing GMs from not just your league but around the world. You're getting to know people. And look, I actually haven't missed a Summer League since it started in Las Vegas.
Do you go and sort of party a bit, or not party, but say have a lot of fun?
Well, a lot of people enjoy that side of it. But for me, it was much more always about the networking. And the fact that I'm going there again, even though my new role with AEG Ogden is much more around some international events that we're looking at. But it's still the place to connect with every single person in the sport from all the continents that come in. You know, CBA guys come in from China, Korea. Korea runs a draft there, typically, in Vegas while the summer league's on. They run their own draft. UA League runs showcases, Japan's there, all the G League GMs, all the NBA GMs. So it's really a very big industry event, and I'm a huge proponent for it. Ironically enough, it's become such a big event in Las Vegas that a lot of the NBA personnel are complaining that it's become too big from a fan standpoint. It used to be very much an industry event, but now you've got sort of 10 and 15,000 people coming into some of these games because they want to see Zion Williamson and they want to see whoever it is. And it's harder than it used to be to just walk around the stands and connect with people. And they've now got these sections to say, right, if you're an agent or if you're a GM, you can actually only come to this section and try to get you a little bit away from the general population. But, you know, 10 years ago, you'd walk around and, you know, you could fire a shot across the stadium and hit no one because there was no one there. But things have changed, and that's a testament to the way the NBA's made that event happen. But it's televised now. It's televised over here now. So it's a big, big event. So I look forward to seeing a lot of my former colleagues there. I think most of them will be there. And I'm taking a few people with me that want to see how the industry works. And it'll be good fun.
And that's at the Thomas Mack Center in Las Vegas.
Yeah, so it's the Thomas and Mack, but also the Cox Pavilion. They run a tunnel between the two thing, and they run concurrent games. And look, Thomas and Mack is one of those big college stadiums. It's actually made by the same people that made United Center in Chicago. It's exactly the same stadium setup, holds almost 20,000. So last year with Lonzo Ball out there and others, there's a lot of people come across from Los Angeles by car and just get there for Friday's games. And,
couple hours drive.
Yeah, so it's a lot of fun, but you know, in answer to your question, the GMs this time of year are essentially either heavily recruiting if they're involved in that process, or heavily getting their nose into the commercials if they're involved in that process.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Jeff. Just quickly, do you like Vegas as a place? Do you enjoy the shows, or do you
find it hollow? No. Well, it is hollow, but I do enjoy it, which is ironic because I'm probably the only person I know that doesn't drink, and. I don't drink and I actually don't party, but I enjoy it. I enjoy the heat. I'm a summer person. It's a dry, arid heat. It's not far from where I was born. I like to see. I was in California. All my relatives are still in Central California, which is actually very similar to Las Vegas in the summer. And I was born closer to Los Angeles. But, I enjoy it. Look, the restaurants are fantastic. It's great seeing people.
Seinfeld, I'm thinking the stayers, the people who've got their standing show now is Jerry Seinfeld's there, Jay Leno's there. I hear Christina Aguilera's there, and she's very good. So
I can't say that I'm actually having any meals with any of them, but if you want the real luminaries, it's Mark Beecroft from Cairns, it's Vince Crivelli from Melbourne, it's Tommy Greer from the Phoenix. They'll be there. They're good enough for me, but I like catching up with those guys. I like catching up with those guys and shooting the breeze. Joey Wright, if Joey Wright can actually be not quite so cheap and live out in one of the outer suburbs where he seems to put himself instead of just come in, Joey, come in close to the town, get in one of the big hotels. Not for Joey. He wants to stay out at the Silver Shoe or something out there. I don't know where he stays, but. No, it's a lot of fun, and we all catch up, and, it is good. And as you said, like, you can be competitive, and obviously I'm not in there with a team this year, but even over the years that I have been, you're competitive, but you're also your colleagues, you know, and you work together where you can and keep other things secret where you can. I know Dean Vickerman's very cagey, so you'll see him walking around, and I'll tell you, if you see him watching a game and he sees you watching the same game, he often leaves to make it look like he's not watching the game, but he'll leave one of his assistants to watch the game. He's a cagey. So, some of those guys are a little bit more cagey than others, but others are just with the honesty policy, and they'll just tell you, hey, we're looking at that guy. Are you looking at that guy?
I would have thought that honesty is the best policy. Like you said, listen, we're thinking about him. I mean, you can see the games yourself. You know what's going on.
Yeah, so it's sometimes pretty interesting to see how everybody does it. But, no, it's a great time, and it's a great industry event.
Jeff, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
I hope you all enjoyed that episode, and there'll be future episodes every Tuesday. And if you have any questions at all, don't be afraid to email me at, or care of, nblpocketpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.